to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 608. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm recording here from Grace Lake, Illinois. Got the studio up and running. Things are looking different day by day, better and better as we go. Jeff knows about the progress that we have and all the things up front, but it's looking good. It's getting better. The lights are better. I replaced everything in here with nice LED lights that... It doesn't look like a dingy, like dirty motel anymore. Anyway, let me introduce to you today. We have our colleague, Jeff Waddington. Jeff, of course, now is Stated Supply out in Fawn Grove, Pennsylvania. And he's been with us for a long time. One of the co-founders of Reform Forum. Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to speak with you today.
Good to be here, brother. Good to be here.
Always love having you. And you got your Westminster shirt on today. You're good to go. And we have an observer in the back. Welcome.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is a man under a brother under care of the Presbytery of New Jersey.
Well, it's great to have you with us. We have a live remote studio audience. It's great to have you.
Dick Chalvalela is his name.
Absolutely. Well,
he would be recorded, but
well, if you want to give him a microphone, he could jump in whenever he wants.
Said, no, thank you.
Understood. Well, we do have two excellent guests today. We're very excited to welcome to the program for the very first time. We'll begin with Travis Fentiman. Travis is graduated from Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary with an MDiv back in 2009. Currently is a probationer with the Free Church of Scotland Continuing, but he's calling in from Vermont. Welcome, Travis. It's great to speak with you today. Great to meet you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you and delighted to speak with you about a book that you have been working on. Let me introduce first, though, a guest we have with him as well, Jim Gerritsen. Jim is a PCA minister. He's formerly a pastor at OPC Congregation, actually had served in the Presbytery of the Midwest, where I'm a minister, and he's also taught at many and several of our Reformed and Presbyterian seminaries and the author of several books. Well, welcome to the program, Jim. It's great to speak with you today.
Glad to be here with you guys.
It's a joy to have you both with us, and we're going to be speaking about a really exciting project and a new book from Reformation Heritage Books titled God, Creation, and Human Rebellion, subtitled Lecture Notes of Archibald Alexander from the Hand of Charles Hodge. So already that's going to raise up a whole host of questions, and we're going to be excited to speak about this, and it's really interesting to think about how this project came to be, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But before we do so, I got just one thing at least I want to remind people of, and that is the Reformed Forum Conference coming up October 12th. The VIP dinner is October 11th. That sold out, so unless you already have a ticket, we're not able to open up and expand more people. That's not an artificial constraint. If anybody knows, has been to that event before, we know that we have a little dining room where we meet, and there's only so many seats that they let us have. And so that we're thankful is sold out. We're sorrowful for those who aren't able to come, but you can check us out next year. But the main conference, October 12th, is still open. There are plenty of seats available. We're meeting, that's a Saturday. All of the main conference addresses are on Saturday, October 12th at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. We'll be speaking about the topic, The Law is Spiritual, which is coming from Romans 7:14, talking about law and spirit as a redemptive historical ages or eras, and focusing on some really interesting passages such as 2 Corinthians 3, Galatians 3 through 4, and of course Romans 7 and Romans 8. So if you'd like to come to that, get online now and register, reformedforum.org/conference. And the early bird rate is still in effect. It's just $55 to come to the conference, and we'd love to have you. The early bird rate will conclude on August 31st. So act now. I've taken it as a personal goal to try to beat our early bird number from last year, and I think we're just about 12 off. So if we can just get 12 people to come on, we're going to turn this into a telethon here. Just need 12 people more to call in. You'd really make my day. But most importantly, we'd love to see you here in Grays Lake in October. It's always a good time, and all the regulars will be back. And we look forward to meeting new faces, new people, and as well as catching up with our old friends. October 12th, 2019. All of it's online at reformedforum.org. All right. Well, let's get down to the meat of our conversation today. I'm really excited to speak about this book for a lot of reasons. One, I always love learning more theology from historic theologians and people that have paved the way before us. So learning from Archibald Alexander is tremendous. But here we have something really interesting because we're not just reading course notes or lectures written by Archibald Alexander, but those that have come from the hand of his student and successor, really, none other than Charles Hodge, another giant of American Presbyterianism. I'd like to start just by asking you, Travis, as you were the editor of this volume, and it has a wonderful introduction here by our guest, Jim Gerritsen, as well. But Travis, I'm curious just to hear you speak about the origins of this project and the story behind it, because I think that itself is really quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is quite unique. Several years ago, I was putting some things together on my website, Reformed Books Online, for both Archibald Alexander and Charles Hodge. And just searching the online libraries for anything I could find by them, I came across this, not knowing what it was. I opened it up, and what do you know? It's a manuscript. And I didn't know they were putting manuscripts up online. And that was something new, I believe, especially out of the archives of Princeton. I mean, the potential for this is just incredible. And so I saw what was his lecture notes on systematic theology is what it was. So I was quite excited about it. I opened it up to look at it, and it's nearly unreadable. It's nearly unreadable. The old cursive handwriting is just like, you know, kind of like what your grandma wrote in, kind of, but just can't even read a word of it. And I, you know, pondered it a little bit, looked at it, tried to pick a few words. I figured, well, you spent some time, you could maybe work through this and get this copied. And sure enough, you probably could. But I wasn't a person alone who had the time to transcribe 240 some pages of this. But I kept it in the back of my head and wanted to do something with it. And sure enough, I got together some friends on the internet who, you know, regular people who are probably better at reading bad handwriting than I am. It's not actually bad handwriting. It's just a different style of handwriting, handwritten notes. And so we were able, with a team of about 10 people or so, we checked each other's work. And that was the meat of it. That was like the hard part to get through. And we got through it within 2 months, which is absolutely great. Shows what a team of people can do. So it went really well, and we did have to go back, and we were, you know, making corrections. You know, it's not always easy to read these things. But that was the bulk of it. And it shows what the average person can do through what's available on the internet today that was not available 10 years ago. So it's just really exciting that this treasure can come to light.
That's amazing. So just in short, you stumbled upon these notes written down by Hodge that had been scanned at some point and put online by Princeton Seminary. And
yes.
Then you coordinated with several other people through the internet whom you may or may not have actually met now. And you put together and transcribed now a book with RHB.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been looking for innovative ways to do new projects for the kingdom of God, for, you know, the reformed world. And there's so much out there. I just hope others will catch on and will find these entrepreneurial ways to help the church.
I think that's really, really a fun story. And it does kind of open up a whole new vistas. You can kind of be like a Reformed and Presbyterian Indiana Jones just from your office, wherever you are, as long as you have an internet connection. It really shows just the wealth of things that are out there. And, you know, the surprising amount of material that is not available to us regularly. You tend to think, well, every book that we might want to read historically is already available to us in the English speaking world. It's not the case. It's not just stuff that needs to be translated. It's stuff that needs to be transcribed or stuff that was lost or needs to be discovered. So this is a fun story, not just because it's of content that's really interesting, but the way in which it came about is quite fascinating as well. Jim, how did you become aware of this project? Were you approached at some point? Were you aware of these notes existing beforehand?
Actually, I was contacted by Jay Collier from RHB, and because of having produced a couple books with them and the other related stuff through Banner, he felt that I would be the right person to write an introduction to this, and so he asked if I would participate in the project. At the time, Travis and I had not met, but then we did have contact after that, and so our lives were sort of intersected through Jay, and really ultimately through Archibald and Charles, which we have yet to meet personally, but I hope we've got it right when we talk about them, because they'll certainly be able to speak to us.
Well, that's great. That's fun too. I mean, I can attest to the fact that people you do meet online and get to know, like-minded folks you can eventually develop a solid friendship with. I have with Jeff myself. I always joke Jeff is my first internet friend. So, and we've been here at we this are, now for years, you know, later. Yeah. 12 years later, still at it. So let's set some of the historical context for this. Of course, I imagine most of our listeners have some familiarity with Archibald Alexander. Not Archibald Alexander Hodge, but Archibald Alexander Hodge gets his name from the Archibald Alexander. And the reason for that is because Archibald Alexander and Charles Hodge had such a close relationship. I'd like to expand upon this and more specifically talk about Princeton Seminary and the context in which they were founded. Really, it's important to understand those things in order to understand where we are presently as Presbyterians, particularly in the United States. But more generally speaking, what would you say, either of you, was the significance of Princeton Seminary and Archibald Alexander to Presbyterianism? What dates are we speaking about here, and what was going on in the Presbyterian world at the time?
It was him at Princeton in 1812, I think the year after Samuel Miller became the second professor, and then Charles Hodge in 1820 and 1822. Became the third professor for basically most of the rest of their lives. And that's where American Presbyterian came from. And it's just great that it had such a solid, godly foundation.
Yeah, and you know, the seminary came into existence at a time when the scientific enlightenment had a huge impact upon American college education. And there was a shift in focus, interest, and emphasis, as well as a decline in morals on college campuses. And Princeton was no longer the place many ministers felt to get that sort of preparatory ministerial training, what there was of it as part of the broad-based liberal arts curriculum. And they felt that the time had come to, in effect, create a school that would specialize in preparation for ministry. And even the study formally of Hebrew was something new at the time. Hodge himself was one of the leading Hebrew experts in the 1830s after his study in Germany, which is just hard to imagine that there were only a couple people here right. on American soil who had the competency. And so he brings that linguistic exegetical skill into his own teaching at a later point, which in its own discussion, if you follow through on that, I find it interesting when sometimes people feel that he was more influenced by the Scottish Enlightenment, when in fact he was an exegetical theologian who worked with the primary text for decades as a foundation for what he did structurally in terms of his teaching of systematics. But at any rate, they had a burden for that, and they wanted to integrate piety and learning as a essential components of making a man of God who would be effective not only as a teacher, but recognizing that what we say has to be rooted in the character of our lives for God to bless it in combination with, as it were, power and demonstration of the Spirit's ministry. And that was the heartbeat of these men coming into, you know, the creation of the school, coming with 20 years of pastoral ministry each, et cetera, and what they brought to how they wanted that school's identity to function. They didn't just want literate scholars. They wanted competent pastoral practitioners who would be leaders to train men.
That's tremendous. I mean, how was this early seminary education? You've alluded to this, you've presented this, what their desire was, but really, just for the listener to explain it a little bit more in detail, how was this different from what had preceded? I mean, what were the predominant models for ministerial training before this, and how was this seminary model, which we just assume is the way ministers are trained because it's so common, but in 1812, this was quite a different thing. How was this new model better suited in the minds of the founders of Princeton to form ministers for gospel ministry?
Great question. So I mentioned the Log College, and Archibald Alexander actually wrote that book on it. Banner of Truth has published it. And previously, I believe it, Dr. Garrison can clarify, but I believe it was with the kind of a new school division in the 1700s that the Log College came out of that context. And again, they met in a log college. It was apparently something like 20-foot wide wall with another 20-foot cabin. Yeah. And apparently the enemies, the people who didn't like it, called it a college kind of in mock. And but nonetheless, you know, people were coming under some regional pastors to be discipled that way. But the step towards Princeton Seminary was more formal, I think, in a good way, more of a classical structure to the education of spending several years in more intense, concentrated study of these biblical languages that not every pastor is going to be able to provide to young students. So I think it was really a fruition, a coming to its own. In a good way, allowed more specialization, allowed a close community between the students and the professors. For instance, the first class of 1812 had three students. When Charles Hodge came in only years later, he was really in some ways taken under the wing of Archibald Alexander, who became a father figure to him. Hodge had lost his father, I believe, when he was 2 years old. It was rather tragic, and his mother had some great difficulty raising the family without the father. And so I just read recently in A. Hodge's biography of Charles Hodge, there's a chapter of his days, his years at the beginning of Princeton Seminary, which if you have it, it's on the net as well. You can read it. They went fishing together. Alexander invited him to stay the summer there. And they did all sorts of things together. That really formed a close bond. Alexander took Charles Hodge on kind of an itinerant preaching tour, Pennsylvania, I believe, and some other areas. And so these were more than teachers, more than professors. They were lifelong mentors. And those friendships were started there at Princeton that would transcend really the rest of their lives as they went their way, broadening and expanding through the nation. Cultivating the leaders that did come out of Princeton.
Yeah, and these men were a combination of godly men, gifted scholar teachers, and outstanding preacher pastors. And rarely do you find all three in one person well developed. And you could even argue that today's educational model has actually diminished that balance and proportion with the emphasis that we often place upon degrees versus character formation. But at the time, yes, that was such a critical part of their own personal relationship in terms of that mentoring and discipling. But it wasn't limited to just that personal relationship between those two men. It was really characteristic of the school as a whole. And it's amazing the affection that you read about these men that was there and their students and the graduates of the seminary and the memories that they had and those kinds of things. When someone takes that interest in you personally, and we probably all have had seminary professors, I hope, in our lives that invested themselves in us in a way it seemed like there was no one else, but they gave all that they had to enable us to learn how to love Christ and to be effective, competent ministers of the word. And while you sometimes forget all that they say, you will never forget who they were. And that impact lives on as a spiritual legacy. And that's the strength of what Alexander and then Hodge in turn was able to give to generations of students there at Princeton. Mm-hmm.
Jeff, I mean, what's been your familiarity with this subject matter? I know you've read widely on Jonathan Edwards and his involvement with Princeton University. Yeah. And certainly also in this context here with Princeton Seminary. But what was your interest with this book when it first arrived?
Well, I mean, I've always been interested in old Princeton. When I was anticipating moving down to the Philadelphia area to take up my studies at Westminster back in 1997, the December beforehand, I got a hold of Calhoun's two-volume set on Princeton. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That that covered the 1812 to 1929 period. And it was just thrilling for me to read that. And literally on the, I had to take a bus, and I forget why, down to my parents in New York City. And then we were going over to Philadelphia. That's what I was reading to prepare myself to begin my studies. And it was a good preparation. What I was thinking about was that, in addition to what we've already talked about, the impetus for establishing the seminary is over against the university. Mark Noel has written a book on Samuel Stanhope Smith and the situation there. He was the son-in-law of John Witherspoon, former president of Princeton University. And it was under his leadership that the seminary came into existence as a related but separate institution for the training of men for the ministry. Because, as Jim has already noted, the number of students going to Princeton who were going with a view toward becoming ministers was dropping. That was the context for creating the seminary as a separate institution. Now, for years, there's been almost very little interest in Princeton Seminary as an institution, as a kind of theology. And Andrew Hofacker wrote the book on piety in Old Princeton. And that, I think, planted seeds for what I would call a revolution in Old Princeton studies, of which Travis and Jim are a part. We see that in the scholarship. Well, you have an old view that the Princeton faculty, at least in the original stages, was overly influenced by Scottish common sense realism, a moderate form of Enlightenment thinking, often referred to as the Scottish moderate Enlightenment, is over against what was going on in France and Germany. In recent years, say from the 70s with Gerritsen, with Hofacker's work, Jim Gerritsen has contributed to this, of course, with his various books, both authored books and edited books of primary source sure. material.
So but, it's a right. It's an expanding and an interesting field. There's a lot of work.
So we have a revolution in Old Princeton studies. We think of Paul Helseth. We think of Fred Zaspel, the two major writers who've called into question what I would say would be rather simplistic notion that Old Princeton was or the men who taught at Old Princeton were simply disciples of Scottish common sense realism.
Sure.
I don't think anybody would deny that there was that was in the air. I mean, it's not unique to Old Princeton. The Scottish common sense realism is the reigning philosophy in 19th century America up into the middle of the century and going in toward the end of the century. It's just in the air. It's everywhere. Methodists, Presbyterians, Baptists, so mm-hmm. forth, that good, bad, or indifferent, this was a common secular philosophy.
Well, let's talk about that sort of idea, talking about the theological and philosophical milieu of the time, because we really are learning a lot of historical theology by reading this book, not just the specific subjects that Archibald Alexander speaks, but the ordering and the emphasis. Travis, I'm wondering if you could speak a bit to the types of sections, you know, the subjects of each of the chapters. You don't have to go through each one seriatim, but just in general, explain to our listeners a bit about what types of material Alexander covered in his course.
Yeah, so we found out, I actually found out a bit later, towards the end of this project, that it's actually only about the first third of a systematic theology. Wow. It's a lecture on systematic theology and covers such a big gamut of it. I just assumed, you know, this is his systematic theology, but it's about the first third. It goes topically through, you know, the theology proper with the being of God, his attributes, predestination and creation in the logical order that's normally gone through covenant works. You mentioned, you know, the context of the Scotch realism philosophy context, he has two chapters that are insightful into that, namely the first chapter and the last chapter. First chapter is on the philosophy of the mind.
That's a really interesting read. I really was interested in that chapter.
He took a great interest in moral philosophy, the philosophy of the mind, and it goes a bit beyond the theology to just the natural way the mind works, truth, you know, the system of truth, and some of that background that he thought was somewhat necessary background to theology itself. And I found it refreshing. Readers might disagree at points if they have strong views on these sorts of things, which gets into apologetics and presuppositions and different things. But I found it refreshing, if nothing else, to read a view that maybe you haven't come to terms with or not that familiar with. He has a great emphasis on the light of nature and general revelation. And he viewed that as wholly in support of shedding light into special revelation. And I find that refreshing. There's a certain direct immediacy, I think, that we gain from nature, from the constitution of our minds, even into these things. So he's not afraid of the light of nature. I think it's helpful. The last chapter is on the will and gets into some of the metaphysics of how the will works. And Jeff, I think, will find a special appreciation for this chapter because he examines it in more detail than I've seen basically anywhere else that I've, you know, flipped through, you know, various systematic theologies. So he treats it in more detail than I've really ever come across before, which is fascinating, and gets into the competing views and philosophers of his day. And he's his own person. He has his original thought, but nonetheless, he has influences such as Jonathan Edwards. And Jonathan Edwards' work has made a big impression on him. If I can mention one point of theology, why did Edwardsianism come so dominantly into American Presbyterianism, and how did it happen? And I think big answer to that is Archibald Alexander. From the beginning, some of the philosophy of Edwards on the will was being taught by Archibald Alexander, who was very influenced by him. So that school of thought is right there at Princeton from the beginning. If I can throw in a theological point, I think it's a bit of a difference from the theology that came before in the 1600s. I think some of us would be aware of Jonathan Edwards' shift on what was philosophical necessitarianism in the day, I think, coming from the Enlightenment context, whereas in the 1600s, especially with the Westminster Confession, chapter on Providence, it talks about God bringing these events about in the created order through free, contingent, and necessary causes. And Jonathan Edwards had the tendency, I think, to collapse that down into necessary causation for most everything and kind of redefined and reshifted the paradigm. Well, Archibald Alexander, he essentially adopts that. He has lots of qualifications, but he essentially lands on the side of Jonathan Edwards. And I think that's a change in trajectory in historic reform thought. That's just one nugget for you.
Yeah, that's of course, as you probably know, Travis, a current debate within our circles. Richard Muller, a few years ago, did a presentation at the Jonathan Edwards Center at TEDS, arguing that Edwards had changed had departed from the tradition advocated by the Reformed scholastics. That has been challenged a little bit by Paul Helm, and also by others who have had the privilege of being involved with dissertation writing. And I think the idea that Edwards departs from the tradition actually has been proven to be a misnomer. But that's another that, in fact, Miscellany 1263 gives a lie to the idea that Edwards collapses secondary causality into primary causality. And there's debate, of course, about continuous creation and occasionalism in the thought of Edwards. That's another topic, but it's interesting that Edwards would have influence in throughout Archibald Alexander, given the reaction of John Witherspoon to the influence of Edwards's idealism and his attempt to clean out the Edwardsian influence at the university.
Samuel Miller actually published a biography. One of the three biographies he wrote was on Jonathan Edwards. And most people don't even know that book exists. It's a couple hundred page biography of Edwards that I think he sort of adapted, but it's under his name in terms of the publication. Alexander also, I believe posthumously, had a book published on Outlines of Moral Science, which is really an expansion of everything that we've just been talking about here. And the other thing, which he does have a small systematic theology that was updated and reprinted by Reformation Heritage Books maybe 10 years ago. And you can actually get his systematic summary treatment there. And it gives you, I think, a good perspective on what he wanted to have actually published that would then be functionally useful in the general society of Christian readership. So it's not a specialty treatment, but it's available for lay people. But the interesting thing, which is kind of the obvious thing about Alexander, is that he is also addressing issues of ethics as much as he's addressing more technical issues of historic or systematic theology. And he did not bifurcate biblical training in a way that it was, as it were, by department, as much as it was the two sides of the same coin, justification and sanctification, and you can't separate them and deal with them responsibly apart from in relation to one another. And that's, I think, the beauty of what Princeton did in the way in which they had not so compartmentalized systematic training or in more writings, piety and learning. And that's, it's just a given at the time, but it's absent in some ways today with what gets published and how theology is taught.
Paul Helseth, a few years ago, had was at Princeton and doing some research through the lecture notes of Archibald Alexander. And he what he showed me was conclusive that old Princeton and Jonathan Edwards on the mind and the will were basically on the same page. And that would go forward not only with Archibald Alexander, but with Samuel Miller, Charles Hodge, B.B. Warfield. The idea that what I argue in my dissertation, the unified operations of the soul, mm-hmm. right? That we are, total depravity means the intellect and the will are equally fallen and then equally regenerated and equally being sanctified in progressive sanctification. Mm-hmm. So that's a helpful, in my opinion, that's a helpful antidote to the view that Scottish common sense realism like had a field day with Calvinism. That's just not true. It's not to say there isn't any influence, it's simply to say that the biblical Calvinistic emphases of old Princeton was there. And when I read it, and I'm a Vantillian, when I read it, I'm very sympathetic and very pleased with what I read. Some years ago, I actually came across a long citation from Dr. Vantill from his Intro to Systematic Theology that I then posted on Facebook and asked for people to tell me who wrote it. And almost everybody guessed Jonathan Edwards. And then I had to say, no, actually, this is from Cornelius Vantill. So on this subject, on this particular subject, on the will, on the mind, I think there was a great bit of agreement, which may have been clouded over the years, that they were actually on the same page, which means that they're attempting to be biblical and confessionally sound, mm-hmm. which is a good thing.
Jim, I'm curious about Archibald Alexander, not only his particular strengths, his characteristics in the classroom, but also just about his theological interests. This is all very fascinating. Is there a way in which this class really sticks out as something new or some emphases that he was addressing within the classroom that we didn't see before historically? Are there things that he addresses in the classroom that our current seminaries are failing to address? What can we learn from Archibald Alexander, both historically and lessons that we could apply even to today?
Well, part of the challenge, at least for me, was him quoting people that I never heard of. And there were a lot of them. And those people obviously had significance. And there's always, you know, generational influence that can pass from one generation to another, such that names are long since forgotten, but who were once relevant for being state of the art in understanding the history of theology. Which to me is an even more challenging thing every year that passes in terms of just trying to keep abreast and then understand the interrelationship of the parts to the whole. I think the larger thing is that truth is truth wherever you find it, and he was faithful to the revealed word of God in his teaching. And I think the strength of what he gives for us today is to go to the heart of what biblical confessional orthodoxy is, with that integration of piety and learning and making sure that there's the balance between the two. And I think that in that respect, he remains exemplary for focusing upon the important things, but also the important things in particular in relation to love for Christ, love for his people, and understanding the proper nature of theology to lead to a childlike humility and dependence upon Christ and the Spirit for everything that we do in ministry. That's really critical. And I think that that's one of the strengths of what he perpetuates for us today. Apart from maybe the intricacies of who he knew and what he was reading. And I believe he was a polymath, and he was a man who basically created the curriculum for the seminary and taught everything himself the first year. And he was reading in biblical theology, historical theology. I mean, he knew the grammars. He taught himself Akkadian and so forth, things that are just beyond my grasp. And, oh, okay, I'll learn this language so that I can teach it to the students.
Right.
It's just, and you know, at the end of his life, he said if he had it to do over again, he'd devote himself to children's ministry.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a little bit like one theologian you might have studied under at Westminster, yeah, who's written so many books, and he's also written children's books on theology as well as profound treatments that adults can benefit from. But he writes for everyone, and Alexander was a man of the people at that point. And, again, a strength that was peculiar to him in the way that God raised him up and used him in a very powerful way.
Yeah, I mean, becoming really a spiritual heir for, I mean, in many ways, a figure that people followed after, becoming kind of a father figure for Charles Hodge, who lost his father at a very young age, but then also not just an instructor, one who's delivering information to students, but one who is leading and guiding them and providing, in many ways, kind of by God's grace, building a foundation for Presbyterianism to come for centuries later. I was wondering, Travis, if you might speak a bit to some of the international context. You know, you're calling in from Vermont now, but you're a probationer, and I'm not saying Vermont's international, but here's my point. As a probationer in the Free Church of Scotland continuing, you know, the roots there being, and the roots of Presbyterianism in many ways being in Scotland, speaking more, you know, ecclesiastically, what was Archibald Alexander's significance, not just to American Presbyterianism, but speaking more, you know, in a global sense? Was he influential and effective, and did other people outside of the United States look to him?
Yeah, I think his influence was more hidden than a broadcast. I'm not sure how much of an international influence he himself directly had, but the people he influenced did. So one of the main emphases he had in the early seminary education was on missions work, and the amount of missionaries and evangelists that that Princeton sent out to the world is rather astounding. I don't have the numbers with me, but in the book that Jeff mentioned, Princeton Seminary by David Calhoun, has a lot of information on Archibald Alexander, and here's just one quote from Alexander. "We regard the missionary cause as the greatest beneath the sun." And in the very founding of Princeton, when they laid out the plan for it in 1811, that document says in the plan of the seminary, as a purpose for the new school, is to found a nursery for missionaries to the heathen and to such as are destitute of the standard preaching of the gospel, in which youth may receive that appropriate training which may lay a foundation for their ultimately becoming eminently qualified for missionary work. And you see something, I think in some ways there's a parallel between Archibald Alexander fostering that missionary influence at Princeton, and also between over in Scotland, the Thomas Chalmers sending out missionaries from the Free Church of Scotland, all in that same time period and progression in history. There's a lot of parallels there. Specifically, around the time that this book was written, taken down by Hodge, which was in 1818, here's an anecdote from 1816. One of the early class members said that Alexander moved the hearts of the students, quote, by their impassioned appeals for the heathen, speaking of the two seminary professors, Alexander and Miller, by their impassioned appeals for the heathen. And so there's a whole chapter in the book I mentioned regarding this missionary endeavor. In fact, it goes on, speaking of one of the missionaries to Hawaii, which we will never hear the extent of until the last day, you know, gathering the natives, working the rest of his life. I believe the last name was, I believe it was a relative of Alexander, one of the younger ones, who was doing that and spent his whole life in Hawaii ministering to the natives, promulgating Christianity and fostering that amongst them. And these are riches that we will not even know the depths of until they're revealed on the last day.
You can look at the chapters and it almost, if you didn't understand it rightly, I suppose that you'd think it was just a checklist, a laundry list, a shopping list kind of thing. But these chapters,
and it has very scholastic too, we should mention, the way the teaching is. There's a question and then an answer in the way all these notes proceed. So that could lend itself to some misunderstanding too.
That's also catechetical.
Yes.
It would be.
It's very good. Right.
Yeah, which I find helpful. I mean, for instance, we've been excited about the public translation and publication of Voss's Reformed Dogmatics, and it's in a question and answer format.
Right.
That means, for me, that's very helpful. Now, of course, the answers are usually far longer than a catechism would give. But what I was wondering, Travis and Jim, is there something that would be unique to this presentation? And you may have to take into view the other two-thirds that you mentioned. This is about a third of the thing. But from this volume, is there any stamp upon it that you could describe as a characteristic of beyond the piety and learning, which we are aware of, which is an absolutely essential element? But is there anything else that suggests that there's a unique aspect to this presentation that would make it stand out from what's typically taught today?
Absolutely. You mentioned the question answer format. It's concise. It's very much to the point, and it gives kind of an outline as it goes through of the topic he's going through. It's very easily digested. I think it's a model systematic theology for beginners. Like, you get that question of, well, what systematic theology should I start with? My answer is Alexander's, you know, by far and away. Start with Alexander. It's simple, it's clear, it's easily repeatable. You can educate back to, you know, the person. You read it, you comprehend it, and you can put it out, as it were, which is can't be said of every systematic theology out there. So on the one hand, it's easy enough for a beginner to pick up and really make progress and understand these Christian things. On the other hand, even the expert is going to find nuances and details that are very interesting and challenging, profound, that, you know, are not found elsewhere.
So, Jim, related to this, is the question and answer format related to the different way teaching was done in those days, with more of a recitation?
Well, yes, I think in part it would be because you know the stories of students in Hodges' class where they were basically expected to regurgitate by memorization and recitation interaction of, you know, what they had learned from him. And I think that rote kind of learning, while some consider it boring, is actually very effective in developing theological muscle memory, so that people are able to reproduce the content and to also learn to use the right words to speak in a concise, lucid fashion. And I think that Alexander's simplicity of speech, and everyone was amazed at him as a preacher. In fact, some people walked out of his preaching because they came to hear a great orator. And one person said, "I just heard an old man stand up and just talk and talk." And he and there were some lawyers, because he wanted you to speak naturally. Right. And so he understood that, you know, true eloquence is rooted in the character of the heart, and that in speaking naturally, we can speak eloquently because we give expression to the convictions of whatever the topic is that we're seeking to address. And I think that simplicity for which he was known, both in his lifestyle as well as in his preaching, also comes through. And ask yourself the question, how would you teach these things to a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old or a 19-year-old? Now, these are young men coming in who already probably know Greek and Latin, maybe you're learning Hebrew, and understand something of the classics. So I don't want to minimize who they were. In fact, they were probably far more advanced than many of us today for what they got in their classical background. But he was working with that age group predominantly. And so what's the best way to maximize their time and also the limited number of books available? And so if you're having to hand translate, which he did initially because books were not available, no internet archive for Archibald to tap in on, doing your research in 2 months, I stood at a copy machine at Princeton all day long at one point in the mid-1990s, Xeroxing page after page of handwritten lecture notes in 2 months. but at any rate, you know, that was, I think, the world that they were living in. And we have to kind of enter back into that world in terms of their pedagogy and the available resources that were there for students who were studying by candlelight, in a lot of cases, and daylight, et cetera. And what's the best way to learn the heart of what you need to know and to focus it that way? And in my own experience, being the simple person that I am, I like to read a variety of authors on the same topic, but I often read the most basic and popular authors to see how they communicated this, and if they communicated it faithfully. And if I can understand that, I follow the breadcrumb trails back as I go deeper into that subject matter. But by beginning there, it gives me the framework rather than trying to stumble into it and wonder what this is really about and what are the important things I need to know or remember. And I think that's where he has a strength with the simplicity and the succinctness of what's there in a busy world, that you could digest that information. It will lead you to ask questions. What's he talking about? Who's he talking about? Because it is a conversation that's larger than what Hodges recorded. You know, he's given the digest of it, but it hopefully will stimulate you to look a little bit further and open up visas of understanding in those topics.
Well, that's good to note that this is not necessarily a verbatim transcript. That there is some selectivity going on with Hodge. And in fact, it's the kind of selectivity that a professor would want his students to have. The contemporary discussion about whether you have laptops or notebooks in the classroom is related to that. If you type what you hear, it tends to be a bare transcript, whereas if you handwrite, you have to select. And professors have generally come down on the side of handwriting because it requires the student to do some assessment. And so that's not a bad thing that we're looking at Hodge's assessment of what was important in the lectures that he heard. So that gives us some insight into Hodge as well as to Alexander.
And you know, the thing I found amazing in reading Samuel Miller's material, he actually stood at a bench and wrote. And he understood the damage that can be done as a student if you're sitting hunched over in a chair. And he admonished against it. And he said, it's not good for your physical health. And he was way ahead of ergonomics when it comes to back posture and the importance of, you know, uprightness and even diet as it pertains to your learning ability.
That's something Edwards was keen on, keeping a record of his diet and how it affected his studies. But I've got this standing desk now. I feel like I'm old school.
You're in the old Princeton tradition.
Standing desk.
I like it. I like it. That's really, really tremendous. So I got to ask, we have an advanced copy of this. I don't actually know if it's available yet. Is it available yet from RHB? Has it been printed?
I believe it's going to be in the next 2 months or so. That's okay. The game plan.
So we just did the thing that our listeners despise the most, is that talk about a fascinating book before they can actually go buy it at the moment. Right. So I apologize to people for that, but the book will be out shortly. It's with Reformation Heritage Books. I'm sure it'll be available online at heritagebooks.org and other places that sell excellent books. Encourage you to get a copy when it does come out. God, Creation, and Human Rebellion. Lecture Notes of Archibald Alexander from the Hand of Charles Hodge. It's edited by Travis Fentiman with a wonderful introduction by our other guest today, James M. Gerritsen. Brothers, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. We hope this will be the first of perhaps many conversations down the road. Thanks for joining us today.
I hope so. Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Well, we certainly want people to check out all the information online. Like I said, you can head on over to Reformation Heritage Books online. We'll have a link to that in the episode description. You can find us online as well at reformedforum.org. And if you'd like to stay in touch with us, there are a couple of good ways to do that. One is by subscribing to our email newsletter, and you'll get updated about upcoming news and things that are happening. And you can also just send us an email. And mail@reformedforum.org or a letter. I like letters. You can send a letter to Reformed Forum, 115 Commerce Drive, Suite E, Grays Lake, Illinois, 60030. Anyway, thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.